Hello, welcome back to Making It Real, a podcast by TKS that follows our alumni all around the world. I'm your host, Isabella, from the 2018 Toronto cohort, and I am so excited to share these conversations, the insights, the tech, the problems that we talk about. So without further ado, let's go make it real.
Awesome. Hello. Thanks anyone who's tuning in. I'm here with Jack. Jack and I were part of the same TKS cohort in 2018 in Toronto, and I distinctly remember your first quantum computing presentation on the screen during cohort four. But after that point, we got to know each other more because we were in the Activate program together and the Innovate program together. And honestly, watching from the sidelines, I was telling you before we started recording that I'm like a Twitter Jack super fan, like love reading all the things. So it's really cool to have you on here. But I will give the mic to you so you can maybe give people a couple of lines about yourself, bullet points, what's important to you, that kind of thing.
Totally. Yeah, thanks for having me on the podcast. I'm excited to catch up. So hi, everyone. I'm Jack. I did TKS for 2 years, I guess. I did both Innovate and Activate. It was so long ago. It wasn't even that long ago, but it feels like a lifetime ago. Yeah, and did the program then. So I am currently going into my third year of a math degree at the University of Toronto. I'm kind of taking a little bit of a zigzag path to finish the degree because I did 2 years of the degree and then I took a gap year this past year to work at a startup. So I think we'll be talking about that a little bit. And now I'm going back in the fall to do my third year and then I'll do my fourth year. And then I guess I'll graduate, hopefully, if they let me. And then right now I'm living in Boston. I'm working at MIT this summer. I've been here since like the end of May and this is actually my last day in Boston. So, you know, it's kind of a nice way to, I guess, reflect on the summer, maybe having this conversation about some of my my takeaways from what's been going on. So excited to be here and
So cool. And you're actually calling in from the MIT library.
I am.
The library is like the math library.
It's the Hayden Library. And so it's like it's the main library on campus. I'm not entirely sure. It's very cool. I like working from here a lot. They have these big windows that overlook like the Charles River, which is really nice. It's a fantastic campus. You know, you got the big dome and stuff. It's like right next to the big, you know, iconic sort of dome. So that's cool. It's been really awesome being here, you know, just like being on this campus because it's just so hallowed, you know, so many really smart people have kind of like walked these hallways and it's just cool to, you know, be where they have been and kind of do my own thing here for a little while. So yeah, it's been a great opportunity.
Do you see yourself coming back?
Yeah, it's a fantastic place. Honestly, I love the people here too. And I could definitely see myself, you know, coming back here at some point. I haven't really decided, you know, what kind of work I want to do in the future, which might sound kind of surprising because I've kind of always been into quantum computing and stuff, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And I think I definitely, you know, want to stay doing like mathy stuff. I've always been like, you know, kind of a mathy sort of guy, but I'm not entirely sure like what subfield I want to go into yet. So I guess it's just a question of whether the right people are at this institution for like what particular kind of subfield in like math and physics I want to get into. So we'll see, but I love the institution itself. The people are amazing. Cambridge is just an amazing place. It's just full of so many nerds. Like, I don't even know how else to describe it. Like, it's crazy. It's so funny. There's like a Starbucks. They're actually like, there's like kind of a road that has a bunch of coffee shops on it right next to MIT. I'll sometimes like go there in the morning and I'll just work there for a little while before I come into the office. And, you know, while I'm sitting at Starbucks or something, I'll just be kind of eavesdropping on people's conversations, you know, as one does. And I swear like 80% of the conversations I hear, people are talking about like biotech and AI and stuff like that, you know, just at the table over. And I'm like, damn, people in Toronto don't talk like this at Starbucks. So it's just it's a city full of like really smart people who are working on really interesting things. And like Paul Graham wrote an essay on this as well, I think, mm-hmm. You know, where he's kind
exactly
of like,
I know exactly the essay you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, no, and it's like completely right. Like it is completely, like the atmosphere here is just so academic and like, you know, intellectual. I just absolutely love being surrounded by so many people working on really big ideas. Like it's like one kind of road where like all of these major biotech companies are located. You have MIT, you have Harvard just up the road. So it's a fantastic place for that kind of stuff.
totally agree. Did you go to the building that's the world's longest hallway? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. So that's the hallway, I guess, where, like, you know, at a certain time of day, it must be at a certain time of year too, when the sun sets, you know, like it goes down and it shines through like the entirety of the hallway. So you kind of, if you're standing at one end of the hallway and you look at to the end, you just kind of see like the sun coming in. It looks very ethereal, like, you know, like the portal to heaven or something. I know exactly the hallway you're talking about. I walk down there all the time, and I can confirm it's a very long hallway.
So long.
Yeah.
And it's near that. There's like a funky statue outside, if you know what I'm talking. I think it's like an orange statue, maybe.
Funky statue. There are a few funky statues
there
around
are.
Here.
That's
yeah, there are some outside. Yeah, there's one kind of in sort of near the hallway that looks sort of like DNA. I don't really know what it is. And then there are a couple statues outside that are kind of funky. I don't really know what they are. But yeah, lots of cool stuff to look at, for sure, around campus.
Have you met anyone that is older than you and you maybe see yourself as a mini version of them? I'm curious if there's someone, you know, like that?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. Not exactly. I think there are people that I meet that where I definitely see like certain aspects of myself in them, or also certain aspects of like the kind of person or researcher that I would like to be in the future. Like, you know, the individual who I've been working with at MIT for this entire summer, he's a very smart guy as well. And we both kind of have really clicked intellectually and academically because we both approach quantum computing from the same sort of angle, which is the very sort of mathematical angle, like looking at the, you know, underlying the math that underlies a lot of the stuff that goes into making efficient quantum algorithms. So intellectually, we're both just very aligned in that regard. So, you know, I definitely see like parts of myself in him, but I haven't really met anybody I don't think that's like exactly like me, which I hope is a good thing, because I kind of, you know, I want to try to just be my own kind of person and maybe like draw on certain aspects of other people that I meet. But definitely, like I said, like aspects, you know, like this guy, the PhD student I'm working with, as well as, you know, my main advisor here at MIT, who's Isaac Chuang. Some of you may know the name from Nielsen and Chuang, like the quantum computing textbook. That was kind of like a mind-blowing sort of moment, you know, getting to work with him. Like, side note, but, you know, when I started in TKS back in 2018, you know, I started my quantum computing focus, and I knew nothing about quantum computing at the time. And I guess I just jumped in by starting to learn about, you know, some of the most basic algorithms. And the book I started reading to begin with was Nielsen and Chuang's Quantum Information. And that's kind of the Bible of quantum information. And now, you know, 5 years later, I'm like kind of working in his lab and I'm like, you know, having lunch with him and stuff, you know, which is insane. You know, I'm meeting with him later today. So it's just wild, you know, like we've come a long way in 5 years. So it's really interesting to look back on.
It's so interesting that you say that, because I've had some other conversations with people who are also 5-ish years out, and everyone's having a full circle moment. Like Shuggin, I was talking with her, and she's working in the lab of her former competitor when she was building Voltex. She's now working at her competitor's lab at CMU.
That's
so
unreal.
It's kind of cool how we like start, and like you said, you didn't know where to begin. So you start with the basic algorithms and you kind of build your way up, and here you are in like less than half a decade, just kind of
Totally. No, and there are so many like full circle moments like that. That's just insane. And a lot of that is because of TKS, which I find really funny. I can give another example as well. Going into this gap year, the company that I worked at for this past gap year, the guy who runs it, he's one of the people that I kind of reached out to when I was in TKS, back when I was in high school, just with questions and stuff. You know, I was kind of implementing some of his research papers, coding them up, you know, trying to understand what he was doing. At the time he was working at Google X as like, you know, leading their quantum team. And okay, yeah, I was looking back through my inbox, cleaning out, you know, my email inbox. And I was looking back on some of our emails from like 2018. And it's just me, you know, this little high school kid, grade 10 or grade 9 or something, sending an email being like, would you be up to have like a half hour chat sometime about your research paper that I read? And, you know, fast forward like a few years and I'm first employee at his startup. But I work for him for like a year, and it's just crazy. It's so interesting how these things come full circle, you know, and it's just about planting the seed, I guess, and then you're sticking with it and seeing it through. And, you know, serendipity, well, it's not even serendipity, it's just planting those seeds goes a long way in the future. Like those seeds will often grow into something really cool down the line. At least that's what I found.
And I also think the most important part is that it comes from a genuine place. Like you were genuinely curious. it wasn't you intentionally placing the seed because you wanted to get hired at some arbitrary startup you didn't even know could exist, right?
Exactly.
And that's what I think makes it really cool.
I think that's exactly right. You know, like at the time, that wasn't even really on my horizons. I was just thinking about the research that he was doing, and it just kind of worked out in the end, which is really cool.
I would love to, kind of on this note of taking that gap year and now working at MIT, and you're kind of entering your third year,
mm-hmm.
What is a mindset that you've been relying on a lot recently?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would probably say, I don't know if this counts as a mindset, but just essentially being very self-reflective and also just adapting to new situations.
Mm-hmm.
So this past year, there's been a lot of self-discovery that's gone on this past year in terms of me figuring out what I want to do, because I've basically gone through a lot of cycles when it comes to deciding the kind of career that I want to have, what kind of work I want to do in the future. So, you know, if I rewind the clock to last summer, you know, I was working at Xanadu, you know, which is another quantum computing company. I was finishing up there. And I was getting ready to take this gap semester at the time, actually. It wasn't supposed to be a gap year. It was supposed to be a gap semester to work at this startup. And at the time, I was kind of getting really disillusioned with school. Well, I wasn't, you know, I still loved doing math. I'll never not love doing math. But at the time, I just really felt that I was in this sort of like artificial environment in school where I didn't really feel like I was in the real world and actually working on real things. So I was really excited to take this gap semester and work at this company and do stuff in the real world. And for a while, it was really great. I really enjoyed it. But I started to like kind of miss the sort of academic setting, like learning stuff for my job. I really do love learning stuff, even though sometimes it is artificial in a sense. It's almost like training, I guess, like training my mind to do really interesting stuff in the future. So I think that whole experience, as you know, I kind of realized more and more that maybe I did want to take a more academic route, at least for like a while I was younger, it required me to really be willing to reflect on what made me happy, what made me fulfilled, and also just kind of be resilient when it comes to, you know, like my situation changing a lot, because everything was always kind of up in the air all the time. Like I was doing this gap semester and then I like had to decide whether I was going to go back to school or take another semester off. So that was really tough to figure out. And it was basically just about, you know, even at times when I felt like, oh, you know, did I make the wrong decision? I don't think I made the wrong decision at all. I think like every single decision that I could have made was the correct one, the information that I had. But it was just a matter of, you know, learning from each individual experience as they happen and just be willing to take these things, you know, and let them like roll off my back sort of and just adapt. So I think that's kind of been the main mindset that I've really tried to elevate for this past year and make it like the core of my sort of mentality.
Love it. It reminds me of a great quote that I sat on a lot last summer, which is, in every great adventure, there's always going to be moments of doubt,
100%.
Which is kind of what you were talking about too. There's so many turning points, especially since you're kind of doing something that not a lot of people do. So you don't have that many examples and you can always just think, why am I working at the first employee must have been really scary too.
Oh yeah.
I love that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, it was. So at the beginning, you know, it was scary, I would say, because I didn't really know what was going on. There was just so much freedom to kind of do whatever. And that was both a really cool sort of proposition, because that meant I had a lot of autonomy over really helping them to stand up like first kind of prototypes of the product that they wanted to build, which was really fun. You know, having that kind of autonomy is just like so cool. So that was really awesome. But it's also, you don't really know like whether things are going to be successful. You know, you kind of feel a little bit like isolated at times.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that regard, it is scary for sure. And that was kind of the case for a few weeks at the beginning. And then they brought on another employee, which was really helpful, I think, for a while. It was really fun. It was just like three of us sort of hacking away on these ideas, jamming out a bunch of nerds, like these two physicists and then me. So that was really fun. Now the company's grown a lot and they're doing really well. And I'm really excited to see what they do in the future. And it's been a really great experience. But yeah, it definitely is, you know, at the beginning, like you have to kind of jump in with both feet, I guess. And again, like I said, you know, it's all about, I think, just recognizing that there are going to be moments of self-doubt in those kinds of decisions, but just like learning from them as much as you can. And I honestly feel as though I've learned so much this past year about like what I want to do in the future. And I never would have been able to discover this stuff about myself if I hadn't gone through this whole experience of both working at the startup as well as coming, you know, to MIT and living here for like the past 3 months. This is the first time I've been out of Toronto like for an entire summer, actually. I've always worked and like lived in Toronto. You know, I've kind of been like the Xanadu house pet for a little while, you know, just like going back there every summer, you know, doing research and stuff. And, you know, they're obviously a Toronto-based company, so I've been just living there. And this is the first time I've really like left Toronto for an extended period of time and lived somewhere different and worked somewhere different. And this has been also like a very transformative experience as well. So, you know, both of those things combined, when I think about this past year, it's just been like an insane amount of learning when it comes to the whole journey that I've taken to where I've ended up.
Awesome. My brain is exploding with questions. So let's start here. I want to hear what your day-to-day looks like at the startup versus at MIT versus what you want your day-to-day to look like now going into third year.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. So at the startup, let's see here. So with the startup, I was working remotely from Toronto. It's basically, it was at the beginning like entirely remote, and now it's sort of, they have a bunch of satellite offices across America, basically. So we had one here in Boston during the summer, actually. So I still kind of did a little bit of part-time work for them this past summer. So we had a few guys near Boston. One of them lives in New Hampshire, so he would drive down. We had another guy who was doing some work as well from Boston. So we had this little like office space right next to Harvard, actually, where we would work throughout the summer some days, which was really nice. But before that, it was all kind of remote. I was working like in a WeWork for a while. You probably know like the Hudson Bay WeWork. I was working WeWork for all of, you know, first semester, like last year, from like September to December of last year. Yeah, it's a great WeWork. So I guess my day to day was like, it was pretty isolating sometimes, I would say. I really like, you know, like go, like exercising in the morning. So I would like, you know, go to the gym in the morning and stuff, U of T gym. And then I go to the WeWork. I'd spend like all day there. And then, you know, I would go home. And at the time, you know, I was living with three roommates who were good friends. So it was nice to be living with them, you know, and like have, you know, some friends around, because I wasn't really like on campus and I wasn't seeing people as much, which was something that I really, really started to miss after a while. At the beginning, it was fine because I was just like, let's build this shit. You know, I'm just going to really focus on standing up prototypes, like working really hard, you know, all the time. And I can worry about, you know, socializing with people later and stuff like that. But after a while, you know, it does get isolating. So that, I guess, eventually kind of got a little bit harder after a while, but that was basically my day-to-day, you know, just like going to the WeWork like all the time, then going home and like hanging out with my roommates and stuff. So nothing too exciting going on there. The cool thing about the startup though is that I got some really neat opportunities to just like travel to some interesting places. So I spent a few days, you know, in Montreal just visiting, you know, the CEO of the company in November, which was a really fun trip. And I got to hang out with Cassia too, which was fun, at the McGill Library. And then in December, I went to San Francisco for the first time because we went to a conference for like a week.
Wow.
So that was also a really fun experience. And yeah, we had a great time there. Really, really cool. And then in April, I got to go to San Diego, which was great, for like an offsite type thing. So that was really fun. And another thing that's, I guess, worth mentioning as well is that, you know, in second semester, I kind of felt like I wanted to get reconnected to the university. So I would start kind of working in the university library a lot more. And that definitely was a good decision because, you know, I got to see some of my friends and stuff a little bit more, which was nice. So I would say that's my day-to-day when I was working at the startup. And then at MIT, the day-to-day is, well, I'm working actually in an office, which is fantastic. Got like an office at MIT here, which is great. So it's basically just working with a PhD student that I'm doing this project with, just working with him like every day of the week, coming into the office. They have a great gym at MIT too. Really like it. If I live really close to it. I'm subleasing at one of like the graduate dorms. So I live a really close walking distance to campus. So I can just, you know, walk to campus every morning, which is fantastic. And then just kind of the same thing, you know, working in the office now. So I feel kind of more connected to people. And then, you know, just honestly, just like hanging out with some friends. Like I had a few friends in the city in Boston, which was actually very lucky this summer. You know, like Sayon was here this summer. So I was hanging out with him.
Really?
I had a couple. Yeah, he was. He was working at Microsoft Research, which was great. I had a couple of friends from Toronto who were doing like their co-op here. So, you know, hanging out with them. But that's about it, honestly. The day-to-day, pretty much the same, but actually coming into an office and feeling kind of more connected to people, which is nice.
So in the future, do you see yourself doing more in-person work versus remote work?
Absolutely. Yeah, nothing beats it, honestly. Just actually being able to really collaborate with somebody, like, in person, actually be able to, like, stand at a whiteboard or something and just, you know, work out ideas, it cannot be beat, I don't think, by any amount of software or even any amount of convenience, really. You know, like, I guess a lot of people will say that, you know, remote work is very convenient, and I think there is something to be said about that. Maybe when you're at a certain point in your life where you have a family or something, and, you know, you want to live somewhere a little bit more remote, and you're just able to get away and focus on your kind of, like, more sort of, like, insular atomic unit. But at this stage, I'm not really at that stage in my life yet. I hope to be at that stage in my life at some point, but at this point, I feel like it's really important to just continue to make connections with new people as much as possible, because I guess, you know, I'm still young, so it's important at this stage.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think there's something really special about having a designated space for your work.
Absolutely.
And I try to do that even in my room and whatever, like desk, like only work at my desk kind of thing. But there's something very different about, like, getting dressed and leaving, like meeting your coworkers or whatever. And I think that's super special.
100%. I completely agree. And you might have, you know, you said you're a fan of my Twitter, so you might have, like, seen when I tweeted, like, you know, I get a lot of my best work done, like, in loud coffee shops, like, you know, not even in my private office, because I just, I like the energy of having people around, you know, it's just like, you know, I like noise, which, you know, might kind of be surprising. A lot of people might be like, oh, I can't work unless it's perfectly quiet. With me, I just really enjoy kind of the feeling of, like, having a lot of people around me while I'm doing something, even, you know, external to the work that I'm doing. Like, if I'm not even talking to them, it's just nice to have people around. And then it's also just nice to, you know, again, like I said, collaborate with people, like, in person, you know, whiteboard stuff. It's fantastic. So I definitely feel as though it's harder for me to work at my house. I try to minimize the amount of time I spend where I sleep, basically. Like, I like, you know, leaving early and coming back late.
Yeah, yeah. And I was really pleasantly, we scheduled this pretty early in the day, and I like being up early, and I think...
Oh, me too. I'm an incredibly early riser. Yeah.
What time do you wake up?
Oh, man. Okay, so that depends. Well, so back in Toronto, I would wake up, like, around, I think, 5:30-ish, maybe. Mm-hmm. Here, even earlier. It's actually, like, too early. Like, some mornings, like, I'll wake up at, like, 4:30 or something. Yeah, it's actually too early, because it's still so dark out. Like, I feel like I should at least, like, try to get a little bit more sleep. But I've kind of, like, unfortunately sort of primed my brain to sort of wake up at 4:30 and just, like, be totally up at this point. So I'm going to try to, you know, push my wake up hour back by, like, an hour or an hour and a half when I get back to Toronto and I sort of reset. Yeah. But I really do enjoy, like, exercising in the morning and stuff like that. So that's kind of why I wake up so early. And I also just like getting an early start on the day, because I just feel like I can just get a bunch of stuff done in the morning, you know, work for the afternoon, and then in the evening I can just rest a little bit and then go to bed early. I just feel, you know, a lot healthier when I'm doing something like that.
I agree. It's totally a feeling thing. Actually, it's so funny. We're talking about whiteboard. I bought, like, a full-size whiteboard.
Oh, that's a good one. Nice.
Double-sided. Because the libraries here get so filled up, especially during exams.
Mm.
I remember once, it was towards the beginning of exams, and there was a group of, I kid you not, 100 people in front of the library, because they stopped doing bookings, and you had to run. So I ran to the 10th floor to get a room.
Oh, like, man.
It was crazy. So anyway, this year I was like, I'm not doing that. Because unfortunately, Chapel Hill is a small place. So you don't have, like, a WeWork you can go to, or the coffee shop gets super full. So, you know, make do.
Absolutely. No, I know what you mean. Like, the library, I've never had an issue with the library at U of T being too crowded.
Interesting.
Maybe it's because there's this one area in the U of T library where I like to work, where nobody else likes to work. It's like these, like, it's like this, like, one little group of tables kind of in this main foyer area. And I think the reason why people don't like to work there is because it occasionally will get noisy with people walking through there. But like I said, I like to work kind of in places that are a little bit noisy. So I always am able to just kind of snag that table, and it's great. So I'm excited to return to that table when I get back to Toronto.
Yeah. So how did you set up your classes? You're excited to return to the table, but what else are you kind of, like, preparing?
Right. Yeah. So basically picked up my classes for this coming semester, modulo a few things that need to be figured out. I won't go into it, but I'm, like, trying to get certain prerequisites waived, and the department's being, like,
same.
You know, they're being annoying about it. So I think I need to go, like, knock on their office door and be like, come on, man, just let me into the class, please. So I'm taking 5 math courses this upcoming semester. I'm really going for it. It's going to be a lot of fun. And I'm so excited. Like, I literally am, I cannot even contain my excitement, actually. Like, I'm so pumped. It's going to be so fun. So I'm taking, what am I taking? I'm taking complex analysis. I'm taking this graduate course, actually, this topics course on hyperbolic geometry, which is going to be a lot of fun. Lots of cool applications to physics there and like quantum computing stuff, like quantum error correction, which is, you know, really cool. And the guy who teaches it is supposed to be a really cool guy. He was the PhD advisor of a really good friend / mentor of mine. And so that's going to be a lot of fun. I'm taking like a seminar course. I'm taking, I think, partial differential equations, and that they let me. I'm taking set theory. For some reason, they're being stupid about the prerequisites, but, you know, we'll figure it out. It's okay. Exactly. And especially when they don't make sense. So I don't want to, like, you know, I don't want to complain too much, but like the set theory, like the one prerequisite they have, it makes zero sense. Like, why it would be listed as a prerequisite. I'm like, these are totally unrelated subjects. So like, what are you doing? Like, why is this a prerequisite? So I'm trying to get them to let me take that course, and, you know, fingers crossed that they do. And then, you know, other than that, hopefully build more relationships with professors, because, you know, like I said, you know, I've been in the quantum computing research space for a long time, and I absolutely adore quantum computing. And I really like the aspect of quantum computing that has to do with the kind of how you can apply different concepts in higher mathematics to getting a good understanding of certain things that are going on when you do quantum computing. That's like that kind of high level explanation. And more simply, I think I just really love math, you know, like that's what I really enjoy doing. And it's great when I can apply it to something like quantum computing. And I think that's, you know, one of the things I enjoy most. But what I really want to do this semester is just do like a lot of math and talk to a lot of math profs and really kind of see the kind of stuff that they work on, talk to them about the kind of stuff they work on, and really figure out the kind of work that I want to do in the future. Mm. Like, there's so, like, the U of T math department is ridiculously renowned. Like, there are so many professors in the department who are absolutely at the top of their field. I would say that it's on par with a place like MIT or Harvard or something like that when it comes to the quality of the professors. Like, it is ridiculous. Like, most of my profs, like, have Wikipedia pages, you know, like the ones that are teaching the math courses. You know, it's wild to see the kind of work that they do, and it looks so fascinating. So my goal really is to just, you know, get to know some of them, really to hopefully just start a dialogue and, like I said, you know, really check out the field and see what's going on. And I'm just so excited about doing that. It's going to be such a fun semester / year, I think, really just learning again as like my full-time job, because I've really missed that. So yeah, it's going to be great.
I think that's epic to hear for so many reasons. One, you're so excited about doing something that's really hard. I feel like I'm surrounded by a lot of people who would look at a list like that and be like, oh my God, it's going to be so hard, or I'm complaining, or I'm not that excited. And sometimes people look at my schedule, which is not as advanced as yours, but like, it's more advanced. I had to get permission and whatever. Yeah. And people are like, oh, that must be hell. And I'm like, no, actually, I was really excited.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And like, I think that I'm just super blessed in the sense that I see math in a way that I don't see it as like something that's necessary or something that I have to like get out of the way. Obviously, like, I would be a pure math student, you know, if I had that kind of mentality. But there's something about math that I just find really comforting as well. You know, it's just like really good for the soul, I feel like, you know, just sitting down, you know, with some math problems and just really thinking them through and just letting yourself be absorbed in them. It's just so meditative. You know, like, I imagine somebody who's painting a picture feels kind of the same way. And I just feel really very relaxed, and I feel, you know, just very at ease when I'm thinking through math problems. So can't imagine, you know, a better way to spend a semester than just working through some tough problem sets and just, you know, really understanding material and stuff like that. Like, I love when, you know, I'm taking a class and I'm really like pushing myself to understand the material at, like, you know, the deepest sort of levels, like where I feel like I could, you know, teach it to somebody else. It's just so satisfying to me. And there have been times in the past where I haven't pushed myself enough to understand the material at that level because, you know, maybe like the course isn't something that I'm as interested in, or maybe like, you know, the professor isn't teaching it in a way that, you know, I really find really compelling. But when I do force myself to do that, or it's not even like forcing myself to do it. I really enjoy doing it, you know, in the right circumstances. I just feel so happy, even though it is challenging and even though like I'm spending a lot of time on it, because it's just so nice to make things click in your head and just feel as though I've added like a new tool to your toolbox, essentially. It's kind of how I feel, you know, when I'm doing this kind of stuff, like when I'm reading a math textbook or something, I feel like I'm just kind of, you know, adding more tools to my intellectual toolbox and that I can use to tackle other problems in the future.
And I think there's something there, which I've been thinking about as well, which is when you can devote your full attention, it feels so much better than when you devote half of your attention to something. Like I find that when I'm like kind of all over the place and I can't fully appreciate or fully go into the depths of whatever I'm learning, it's not like I'm getting half the value. I'm getting even less than half.
Right.
When you put everything into it. And also, it's kind of like on that note, I feel like a lot of people are just doing classes to do them for some other thing. Like I'm in organic chemistry and everyone's just doing it because they want to get into med school and they're all uptight about will they get their MCAT score or whatever. And I'm just like, I just want to be around people who are just grateful for their opportunity to be in an educational environment, and they don't look at their schedule and they're like, I'm in organic chemistry, I want to die. Like literally words I've heard this week many, many times.
Yeah, no. And you know, it's all about, you know, finding what you really feel as though you're passionate about. Exactly. And, you know, it's hard at the beginning of your academic career because a lot of the time you have to take kind of like a wide range of courses. Like you don't really know what you want to do yet. So it's understandable when people, you know, get frustrated, I think in their freshman year or something with certain courses and they feel as though, you know, oh, you know, this is terrible. Like, why do I have to do this? I really don't enjoy this. But, you know, now that I'm kind of, you know, getting into my upper years of school, I can just do like, you know, everything that I know what I want to do, and I can do, you know, everything that I want to do if the department lets me. So that's just like such an exciting and, you know, sort of like freeing thought. So again, like you said, like it's all a matter of like getting to that point. And I'm really excited about it. It's going to be fantastic.
Epic. What about industry versus academia?
Yeah.
And your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So I think there are pros and cons to both. And, you know, having kind of done, I guess, both at this point, I think that when it comes to industry, there's definitely like less kind of intellectual freedom in picking the problems that you're going to work on. There's a lot of freedom usually in picking how you're going to solve the problem, because, you know, a lot of the time in industry, like you'll have a problem and then they're like, solve it. Like, I don't care how you solve it, just solve it, which is cool, because, you know, if the problem itself is interesting, then, you know, in theory, like the sky's the limit. While I was working at this company for the past year, there's been this problem that we've been working on for a while. It's a very interesting problem related to quantum many-body physics. It's a very difficult problem, mathematically speaking, as well. And basically, it's almost like, okay, we need to solve this problem. Like, it doesn't matter how we solve it. Let's just, you know, solve it somehow. And we're finally at a point where I think that we've come up with like a pretty satisfying answer to this problem. So like we're kind of writing a paper on it right now, which is really cool, because we were able, or, you know, me and I guess, you know, this other physicist of the company were kind of able to go through the whole journey of, you know, starting with a problem and just, you know, using whatever tools we had in our repertoire to solve it. So that was really fun. When it comes to academia, you also have the freedom to like select the problems you want to work on as well. Mm-hmm. And that is like, you know, total freedom, which is, you know, scary sometimes. And it's difficult because, you know, coming up with problems is like one of the hardest parts. Coming up with good problems, rather, is one of the hardest parts of doing research, I feel like. But when you come up, I think, with like a really interesting problem that you're really passionate about, and then, you know, you're able to solve it, that is just like, you know, so satisfying and so fulfilling, I feel like. When it comes to academia, though, it's easy to kind of start working on problems and then realize that they're not very applicable to, you know, much, or like, you know, there's not going to be much interest in the problem outside of, you know, a very kind of a very small community, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. Mathematicians, like all mathematicians do this. Like they work on, you know, problems that are only of interest, like a very small community for the most part, at least at, you know, the time they're working on it. But, you know, as they progress in the future, like there have been so many papers that have been small little things that have eventually grown into these things that are huge results because people have realized how useful they are. I'll give an example. Working on this project during the summer, this didn't end up being the project that we eventually were writing a paper on, but we were working on some other ideas near the beginning of the summer, and, you know, some of the previous work we were using were these random, like, Russian mathematics papers, like, from the 60s or something that have, like, you know, 5 citations, and I'm like, wow, you know, it's a very niche problem these people are solving, but it's kind of exactly what we need. So it's difficult to know at the time, I feel like, you know, the impacts that your work could have in the future in academia. So as long as you feel, I think, that you're doing something like novel and interesting to your community, then that, I think, is definitely good enough. And, you know, it's all you can really be expected to do in academia, and it often leads to really interesting results. But yeah, I've gone off on a bit of a tangent. So yeah, the freedom to choose your problems in academia is definitely, I think, a big thing that differentiates it. And it can be a good thing and a bad thing, like I kind of explained. In academia, there's a lot more like politics in academia, posturing and, you know, writing grants and trying to get people to give you money, because it's difficult to, you know, get money in academia. Like, you know, in industry, like, money is like infinite, you know, right? You know, if you're like a scientist at a company, it's just like, you know, you need money, like, here. So I haven't really had that experience with academia, because I'm not like a PI. I'm not even a PhD student, right? I'm just like, you know, kind of a visiting research student, I guess, you know, so I've never had to worry about that kind of aspect of academia. So, you know, I'm kind of seeing academia through rose-colored glasses in a sense, I feel. Mm-hmm. But I've heard from a lot of people that can be like a big negative aspect of things. So I think it's just a matter, again, you know, of balancing like that stuff with like the more freedom that you get from academia. So I think that's like kind of the main comparison. And if I had to think about, you know, what I want to do in the future. Yeah. Anticipating the next question.
Yeah.
So, you know, I flip-flop back and forth on this so much, like over this past year alone. You know, when I started working at the company, a startup in the fall after Xanadu, I was of the mindset that definitely not doing a PhD, like, this is a waste of time. You know, what am I going to do with a PhD? Like, this is just stupid. Like, I'm wasting my prime years working on, you know, some random set of problems that nobody's going to care about. Like, I'm going to go start a company. And after having, you know, been in that sort of environment for a while and then coming to MIT and being in the academic environment, I'm kind of realizing that at least, you know, while I'm young and, you know, while I feel as though maybe the most creative or something, I don't know, like, this is like the most creative I'll ever be in my life, but I feel like it's a really good opportunity when, you know, your mind is still kind of unmolded by others' ideas to really like jump into research. I feel as though, you know, it would be a good time for me just to like explore, you know, while I'm young and really try to work on like some interesting ideas with like total freedom. And then after that, decide what I want to do when it comes to academia or, you know, going into industry or starting a company or something like that. So I've definitely kind of come full circle from totally not wanting to do a PhD to like totally wanting to do one. So at the very least, I would like to go to graduate school. And then after that, I don't know yet. I guess it's going to depend on, you know, how I feel after I'm done with the graduate school, but that's kind of a long ways away. So I think my mindset's going to change a lot between now and then. So I guess we'll see.
Yeah, that's epic. On the note of graduate school, do you feel particularly about a place you want to go to graduate school, like Toronto versus Boston, or you don't know yet?
So I don't know yet. And yeah. I think the thing about graduate school is that it's mostly about the advisor, right? It's not about the school. It's about finding like the right person to guide your research. So wherever I find somebody who I really feel as though is the right person to, you know, really work with on a very interesting research program and really mentor me, that's where I'll end up going. And I don't really think it matters where that is. Obviously, there's utility to being in, like I mentioned, like a nerdy city like Cambridge, Massachusetts, right? But I don't think that anything can be, you know, having a really top tier advisor. So like, I would totally rather go to a school that's in like a really like small place, you know, in the middle of nowhere with a really amazing advisor than go, for instance, here with like a mediocre advisor, but be in like kind of a really electric sort of town, you know, where there are a lot of smart people. I don't know if I want to stay at U of T. I probably want to go somewhere different because, you know, a lot of people will talk about trying to get new intellectual experiences when it comes to going to undergrad versus grad school. So I'll probably, hopefully, end up going somewhere else. But I want to try to meet as many people as possible and just figure out exactly, you know, the kind of person that I would like to hopefully have as my advisor for grad school. So that's going to be, you know, a big goal of mine for the next couple of years.
That's awesome. Do you think that this person that you'd want to be advised under would be really different from you? Or do you think you'd want someone who's, what would be some of the traits off the top of your head that you'd really want to think about in evaluating?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I think that I probably would want somebody that I feel is aligned with my mindset about, you know, at least the general kind of research direction that I want to go. When it comes to like personality, though, I don't really have any preference, to be honest. I feel like there's so much to be gained from people with different perspectives and, you know, personality that's different from yours. There's also, you know, a nice like compatibility that comes with somebody who's similar to you when it comes to just being able to work with that person every day. So honestly, I think there are like benefits to both kinds of individuals. The only real criteria, I think, is that we're aligned when it comes to the kind of work that we want to do. And then I think I would sort of just take like the benefits of whatever kind of person I get, like personality wise, unless they're just like a really terrible person, in which case I probably like, you know, wouldn't want to have them as my advisor. But I've actually talked to some people about this as well. And it's also important to, you know, make sure that your advisor is the kind of person who actually really, I guess, cares about their students and really, you know, wants to like foster their success and create a good environment for their success, because a lot of advisors are not necessarily like that. And so it is important to select based on, you know, that particular personality trait. So yeah, it just comes down to choosing somebody who's like, you know, one, aligned with you when it comes to, I think, work, and two, you know, just actually wants to see you succeed and has the tools to help you succeed.
Yeah. So I was listening to Noble Minds from last year, and something that struck me was of the quantum compute, the researchers who won the prize and their work contributed to better than I do, but I think it was quantum information theory or something like that. They were talking about how their advisor in grad school once a week would have a call for like 15 minutes with them, and they had to come like super prepared. But after a couple of years, they kind of like cracked in the way, and like, because you only had 15 minutes a week, one time the advisor gave them like 3 hours to go through something. And it was like this big moment of like, whoa, like we've earned this man's time. Wow. But I'm curious, like with that example, I think that's kind of different than what I would imagine conventionally someone who wants like really foster their students' growth, instead of doing it in a way of being like, hey, Jack, like I want to give you all my time and resources, and like, I'm here for you always. It's kind of the opposite, and you almost have to earn that respect. What do you 100% think of that?
No, yeah, totally. I don't think that, you know, it's necessarily best for an advisor to just be like, you know, constantly available or something, or just holding your hand the entire time. It's really important for them, I think, to not like throw you into the fire, but just let you kind of like develop into your own independent sort of person. So I think, you know, an advisor, again, you know, I don't really have experience as like a PhD student or anything, but, you know, from working with profs in the past on research projects and stuff like that, you know, like people that I work with at Xanadu, I think it's important for an advisor to sort of, you know, be that guiding hand, like to be somebody that you can bounce ideas off of. But I think often, like, you should be the one sort of going to them and like querying them and getting their feedback. But at the end of the day, it should be you that's really like driving the boat when it comes to, you know, your work and developing sort of your own ideas, I feel like, because that's really what's going to prepare you, I think, to be a good researcher in the future and really be able to, you know, come up with good problems and solve them. So that's what I mean, you know, somebody who's just willing to kind of like let me be independent and like, you know, work on the kind of ideas that I want to work on, but also is willing to be there as like a foil to like bounce ideas off of.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. So let's do a couple of rapid fire questions, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Awesome. Actually, this one I just came up with, wasn't in the list that I sent, but I would love to know if there's someone you think that deserves a Nobel Prize in physics that hasn't gotten one yet.
Oh, that's a good question. If somebody who deserves a Nobel Prize in physics, I would say I'm sort of biased because I see him like every week, but Peter Shor, you know, Shor's algorithm. Yeah, I think he deserves a Nobel Prize. Like, he's done so much good stuff. And I'm sorry, I know this is supposed to be rapid fire, but
no,
we have
expand. This is a good point.
We have a Friday colloquium here at MIT, you know, like most Fridays, I'd say. And most Fridays, Peter Shor shows up, right? Like, and the first time he showed up, I was like, my mind was blown. I'm like, damn, like, here he is, like, you know, in person. Like, this is absolutely insane. Like, he's just sitting here beside me, like, at the Friday colloquium. So that was just, like, such a cool moment as well. But, you know, all of the work that he's done in quantum computing, like, he definitely deserves, I think, a Nobel Prize. And I think some people who will eventually deserve Nobel Prizes in physics are some people working on, like, non-equilibrium thermodynamics, but, like, the Santa Fe Institute. It's just such interesting ideas. So hopefully that work tested in practice in the future, and they eventually, you know, also get the prize. So, but yeah, that's my answer.
Those are awesome. And what's the next big thing that you don't think a lot of people are talking about?
Yeah, so non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. I didn't want to say like quantum computing or anything like that, because a lot of people are talking about quantum computing. Hopefully we're going to have them like in the coming decades, at least at like, you know, a certain level. But something that I think is really interesting right now that not enough people are talking about at all is complexity. And, you know, like I said, non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. So, you know, there's so many ideas in the physical world that are like so complicated that they should be modeled by like ensembles of many kind of interacting agents that, you know, have sort of probability distributions that govern their behaviors. And then you can, you know, look at quantities like entropy and stuff like that, which characterize their behavior and their properties and stuff like that. And these kind of ideas have applications to everything, biology, to like electronics, to like any sort of like communication channel that exists in the physical world. These ideas are absolutely fascinating. The Santa Fe Institute works a lot on this kind of stuff. They have a really good podcast called The Complexity Podcast that people should check out. They really are working on some really, I think, neat things that are really like fundamental to, like they're almost like even like more fundamental than like most physics that people work on, which is absolutely crazy. So I absolutely love those kinds of ideas. And I think that eventually they're going to be really important and I think deserving of like something like a Nobel Prize, like I said.
Yeah. Is there an intersection between them, between non-equilibrium thermodynamics and quantum computing?
Yes, I think so. So I think there's definitely an intersection between just like quantum information in general and, you know, non-equilibrium thermodynamics, because a lot of people argue, you know, the universe like is quantum and that, you know, it's best to understand things like a quantum mechanical terms. And then a lot of people will kind of take this further and say, you know, like quantum information is the thing that kind of governs how the universe behaves. And there are a lot of people who study the relationships between things like quantum information and like black holes and stuff like that. And so there is things like quantum thermodynamics as well. And, you know, looking at the parallels between quantum thermodynamics and classical thermodynamics and classical statistical mechanics is a very interesting thing because, you know, they predict different behavior, which is really cool. And sometimes, you know, you want to use one, sometimes you want to use the other. So there definitely are relationships for sure.
And I think that's super cool. Right now I'm in a class that's studying quantum mechanical models of chemistry.
Nice.
It's awesome because not only is it super interesting, I think it's so applicable to, like, as a metaphor for relationships in the real world or how stuff happens in the real world. I don't know if you enjoyed this about, like, science and physics and math, but I really like learning about something like, here's what atoms do when there's a lot of electron repulsion in this particular orbital. And I just start to think about how that
totally
relates to actually how humans, like humans are just big clumps of atoms. And I like studying the atoms so that I can like interact, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, there's lots of analogies to be drawn between different fields, yeah.
Totally. And I think right now I'm really like, I'm learning about like G orbitals, just like in higher, and we've actually been able to like access them through like super high energy redox reactions in chemistry, but we've never found like a stable G, like never in like finding an element with naturally existing G orbitals. Anyway, like so many cool things that a lot of people are, or not a lot, like a lot of these like niche circles that you described are really excited about because
absolutely
we're going to unlock. Also, did you know that there's an element called tennessium, and it was discovered in Tennessee, and it literally only existed for like a couple of femtoseconds, and it's now on the periodic table.
I know the element. I didn't know that. So they've only created it for a few femtoseconds. That's wild.
But they use like a huge particle accelerator, and they like created the element, but literally like less than a second.
Wow.
And that's all we know about it. We just know it can exist. And it's just so, it's so cool to me how we look at something like the periodic table. And it's like, most people look at it and they're like, oh, that's the periodic table. It's exact. Like, you know, that's how it is. And you realize after element 86, we've created all of that. We have no idea if periodic trends exist, like if they still continue on. We have no idea if we can actually like use these elements for things in industry. But it's like, people's curiosity pushes them so far.
Yeah, no, and it's so random too. Like, I just wonder like how much further we'll be able to push like, you know, synthesis of these like synthetic elements as well. Like I wonder, you know, if we can create even heavier elements, right? Like, it's crazy because like you said, we have all these like unstable elements. Can we go even further? I don't know. Like, it's weird, and it's so weird. Like, why should they stop at this point? Like, why shouldn't we be able to create elements with more protons or more like you know, different isotopes with, you know, more neutrons or something? Like, it seems like we should, maybe, but maybe it's just really hard. So I guess we'll see what happens in the future, but it's very exciting.
Totally. So who or what is a topic or someone that inspires you a lot? And I feel like you've touched on some of them, but if there's any other nerdy things.
Yeah, so like, I think at a high level, it's just like anybody who's like really unapologetically good at what they do and like uncompromisingly good at what they do. Like, I just really have a lot of respect for people who really kind of pursue something and are just really focused on it and are willing to kind of make sacrifices to just be like really good at that thing. Like, I come from a family of people who are like really into tennis. Like, my sister's a tennis player. Watching like something like, you know, Wimbledon or whatever, and seeing like there's this like kid like Carlos Alcaraz, right, who just won Wimbledon.
Mm-hmm.
He's like younger than me, and just like, you know, I love seeing stories like that, right? You know, like people who are just so unapologetically like great, and they're just, you know, willing, and they have like kind of like the willingness and the bravery just like take on the world and just be the best. I absolutely love that. And You know, I love stories of just like heroic people or people who are like, you know, amazing leaders. Like, I absolutely really do love that kind of stuff. I love stories of like, you know, people who pioneer new ideas. Like, I was listening to a podcast with like, you know, John von Neumann, right? Who's like, you know, arguably like one of the smartest people to ever live. The kind of guts it takes, but also just like the dedication it takes to like pioneer so many like different areas of like thought is just, you know, so inspiring to me. And then, you know, like at like a more like fictional level, I think a book that every young person should read is The Fountainhead as well, because, you know, it just talks about the ideal man in a certain sense. And, you know, I find that entire, you know, story just, you know, I like drawing upon certain like lessons, I think, from that story and try to, you know, kind of live them in my own life. Yeah, I think that's what I would say.
I just gave The Fountainhead a quick Google. I have not read it, and it's by Ayn Rand, right?
Yeah, Ayn Rand, yeah.
Okay. Ayn Rand. Okay. I need a book right now. I've like just finished all my books, so that's a really good, actually useful piece of information.
Yeah.
What is something you are bad at but love doing?
Yeah, this is a good one. So I think there are a couple ways to answer this question. I'll start off by actually answering the question, and then I'll answer a slightly different question. So one thing that I am bad at that I enjoy doing and I want to get better at is cooking good food, because I really enjoy like cooking really like good, healthy food that tastes good. But, you know, when I'm left to my own devices, I'll often eat like a rabbit sometimes. Like, you know, like I'll just make plain chicken and broccoli or whatever. So one of my goals for like this coming semester, actually, when I get back to Toronto, I'm moving into like a new apartment, got like a bit of like a nicer kitchen now, which is nice. So like my goal is to actually prioritize just like making like good meals and like getting just better at cooking. One of my roommates is a really good cook as well. One of my previous roommates, he was a really, really good cook. So I kind of want to, you know, draw inspiration from him. And other than that, I think there are a lot of things as well that I'm bad at and I don't necessarily see myself ever getting good at or necessarily wanting to get good at, but like I appreciate so much. Like I absolutely like adore things like art and music, but I'm not musical. I'm not like an artist or anything. Like I'm not like a painter, but I just like, I absolutely love like freaking appreciating really good art or really good, you know, music, like going to an art gallery or something, or like listening to like some really good music and just thinking about it and thinking about, you know, the kind of thought process that went into like making something like this. So that's kind of my mentality when it comes to like a lot of art, I feel like. Like it's something that I'm bad at, but I really, really enjoy appreciating, not necessarily doing.
Yeah, I'm aligned with you on the art. Wait, comment on the cooking. I have two tips. I'm also not the best at cooking, but I like cooking healthy things. Something I discovered last week. It's if you take red cabbage, you like slice it up, put Mike's hot honey, a little bit of like salt, pepper, a little garlic powder, and like cook it in the oven for like half an hour on like 400 Fahrenheit. So good. It's like healthy chip. It's delicious.
That sounds amazing.
And it's so easy, but like and it's like super easy to meal prep. Like I just have a bunch of cabbage like cut in my freezer and I just like put it in the pan. Little hot honey, a little bit of seasoning in the oven. So easy. Salads, like soups, everything.
I will have to try this. It sounds great. Have you ever tried like kale chips in the oven before too? Those are so good too.
And I really like them.
Putting kale in the oven with like sea salt. Oh, so good. So good. Like
it's
olive oil.
It's basically kale chips, but cabbage, but with hot honey. It's like a
The hot honey. That's a good idea. Yeah.
And then a few days ago, I attempted to make a trifle cake, which I don't know if you like.
Yeah, I know exactly what it is.
Cake. But they didn't have Angel Food Cake at the store, so I was like, I guess I'll make it from scratch. How hard could it be? And I did it. And it was freaking awesome. Like, literally the best cake I've ever had.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah. My goal, when I get back to Toronto, you know, like, one of the things I really want to make, I absolutely love, like, carrot cake, and I haven't had it in the longest time, and I want to make carrot cake so bad.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. I'm curious. This is, like, another random rapid fire, but is there somewhere that you want to go or an experience you want to have in the next 6 months?
Oh, yeah, it's a good question. Let's see. I don't really have anything in particular. I feel like I'm really excited just about like getting back to Toronto and going back to like my kind of school routine and just being with friends and stuff. There are a few kind of academic institutions and people that I would really like to, like, in an ideal world, like I would love to, you know, go visit them or whatever. Like there's some really interesting people working at some institutions across the United States, you know, at Caltech and stuff like that, and at like, you know, the Simon Institute at like Stony Brook University and stuff like that, or the Curran Institute of Mathematics at NYU and stuff like that. So, you know, ideally, like, it would be so cool, you know, go like visit those kinds of people and like talk to them about some of their work. But other than that, not necessarily. I don't really have anything planned find out. Cool. We'll see if anything happens. But yeah, it's just, I am excited just to, you know, kind of be in Toronto for a while. And then I guess we'll see what happens maybe like, you know, in the new year or something. And if I want to really go somewhere different and try something different. So yeah.
Yeah. It's so funny because we're talking so much about Toronto and I'm literally burning a Toronto candle.
Wow.
They're called homesick candles. My friend got it for me last year for my
birthday. Oh, man.
It's supposed to smell like the city, which honestly, I think they did a good job. Like, I don't even know how to describe it, but it's very like woodsy kind of, but like,
oh, woods. Do you miss Toronto?
No. Every day. I miss Toronto so much. I miss being in a big city. I miss like the vibrance. I miss like autumn in Toronto.
Oh,
I miss like work life and WeWork. I miss it so much. Yeah, and I was in London for a few days this summer, and I was like, this is really similar to Toronto. Not, you know, not exactly, but like a beautiful, interesting place.
Mm.
But yeah, I was also living in Singapore, and I miss Singapore. Singapore, very homey. I love it.
Very nice.
Yeah. And actually, I have a recommendation for you on the art note. I am also like an appreciator of art, but I have like zero artistic abilities.
Yeah.
But when I was in Denmark, I went to this museum called the Louisiana Museum of Art, and it felt like such a vivid experience. Like, I don't think I'd been to many art museums by that point, because it was a couple of years ago,
right.
But it was, like, phenomenal. And in general, Scandinavia is this, like, very minimalist, like, appreciating art place. So if you ever go on, like, a trip, just for, like, the sake of fun, I think, like, Scandinavia would be really cool for you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that would be awesome. Also, on the art note, one more thing, too. Recommendation for anybody in the Cambridge area. The Harvard Art Museum. It's free on Sundays, and they have like a ridiculous collection. Like, they have Van Gogh, they have Monet's. My personal favorite artist is Hopper, and they have like, you know, a bunch of Hopper paintings as well. It is an incredible art gallery, like right next to Harvard, and you know, you can just walk in there on Sundays. It's amazing. So check it out.
Really what cool. a hack. I really hope people listen to it and like a couple people go and then they start spreading the news like wildfire. That's
Yes.
Yeah.
Very good.
Okay, two more. What's a piece of advice you would give to your 13-year-old self?
Yeah, so I think I would probably just tell myself to be, like, open to new experiences and, like, you know, not close myself off. Because, like, you know, as a 13-year-old, I feel like I was just, like, really nerdy and introverted, as, like, a lot of us were, I think. Like, I think I remember, like, reading a Medium article that you wrote or something, and you kind of said that you were sort of the same way maybe a little bit, like, when you were younger. I just kind of would probably encourage myself to, you know, really try to open myself up a bit more and, you know, try to be friends with like all different kinds of people. And also just to, I don't necessarily think it's like good to really over-optimize when you're really, really young, maybe, because, you know, you're still kind of figuring stuff out, just like being a kid and, you know, experiencing childhood like in the moment. So I don't think I would tell myself, oh yeah, like, you know, think about like exactly what you want to do in the future. But I think I would probably just tell myself to like, try new things, as vague as that sounds, and to buy Bitcoin, obviously. No. mostly just try new things, I think, And just to really kind of, like, prime myself to figure out, to be the kind of person who can figure out what they want to do in the future.
Yeah. And to end off the podcast, what is something that everyone should experience at least once in their life?
Yeah. I think traveling with friends is one of the biggest things. Mm-hmm. So last summer, right after school ended, I had the opportunity to go to Greece for a couple weeks with a bunch of my friends. First time I had gone like on a vacation with just friends, not family. So I went with my roommates and a few of our friends. We went to an island south of Athens. My roommate, his grandparents, like had a house there. They have a house there, so we just stayed at their house, like on this kind of remote sort of Greek island, and we just kind of spent our days like boating around and like fishing and hiking and stuff like that. And it's just like the most unbelievable like sort of bonding experience with your friends, experiencing like a new kind of culture in a new kind of place, like with people who are, you know, outside of, I think, your kind of immediate family, is just like such an incredible sort of thing to do to really like bring you closer to people, really like help you like open your eyes, like new perspectives and new sort of like cultures. I think that's a super amazing thing that people should do when they're young, if you know you have the means to do it. Like, it doesn't even have to be like, you know, far away or anything. You don't have to go to Greece or anything, but just have kind of experience where you like, you know, go somewhere different with, I think, your friends, you know, no matter how far away that ends up being. And then I'd also think, you know, having experiences where you go places alone as well is important, and you know, figuring out where you see yourself in the future. Like, this whole summer in Boston has been like super transformative in that regard. Like, I came here, you know, alone, first time, you know, kind of being away from Toronto for a summer, really trying to acclimatize to sort of like a new place. And, you know, culturally, it's like not different like at all, basically, from Toronto. Like, I can't even I can't even imagine, like, you know, someone like you, you know, like you went to places that were totally culturally different, like by yourself, and that like must have been crazy. So like, you know, doing stuff like that, even to like, you know, kind of like the minor degree that I've done it, I think is also a really important thing that people should try to do when they're younger and they're kind of trying to find themselves and figure out what they want to do in the future.
Amazing. I think this is one of my favorite podcasts I've done. I've had such a good time. Thanks
yeah,
so much.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Amazing.
Thanks for catching up with us. That was Making It Real by TKS, and I'm your host, Isabella. I hope you have a crazy audacious week, and I will see you next time.